Molly. Former worship leader turned mystic, your friendly neighborhood imagination doula and artist, I truly believe in the power of imagination, that creativity can lift us out of the darkest places, transforming us and our world as we come home to ourselves. I want you to know that you are darling and so loved, and that coming home to yourself and reclaiming your full expression is the most revolutionary thing that you could do. Welcome to the Darling Revolution Podcast. Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Molly. I'm so excited today to introduce you to someone who's very important to me. Fanny Priest is a trauma repair coach with a background as a yoga therapist, and she helps healers, feelers, queers, and creatives repair the relationship with themselves so that they can feel at home in their bodies, their feelings, and their needs. I have learned so much from this human, and also she happens to be my official work wife. So welcome to the podcast, Fanny.
It's so good to be here with you, Molly. I'm so excited to see your face.
Yeah, yours too. Also, for those of you who are just listening and can't see the visuals, Fanny's got this rainbow hair now that's like so good.
It is so good. I was, this is the first time like I had what they call virgin hair, the first time that my hair was bleached ever. Wow. At 42, because I feel like, you know, 2021 definitely demands it. Like if you haven't had your hair bleached before, now is definitely the time. I'm in the learning curve of, okay, so this is starting to fade now. And what is my next step? Like, what is my regimen, you know,
with
the dying of the hair? Which I feel like you can be like really helpful in helping me navigate.
Oh yeah. I've been dyeing my hair since age 16, and this year was the year that we shaved it all off too. So, you know, 2020 was a big year for like transitions in hair.
Absolutely. Definitely. All of the things, but yeah.
All the things. So for people who don't have the privilege of knowing you yet, would you mind talking a little bit more about what you do and like the spaces that you hold and the medicine you bring to the world?
Yeah, that's like, I'm like, wow, that feels like a big question. I felt like I just kind of want to reflect like what it was like to have you read my bio earlier. Like that felt like a really kind of like special thing. I think that in the work that I do and the conversations that we have together, we talk so much about witnessing and how witnessing is such an important ingredient in trauma repair, in healing, you know, in general. And yeah, that was a sort of like cute little unexpected moment of being witnessed, just to have you, you know. And those are my words, right? Like those are the words that I use, but it was something really different about having somebody read them. And I'm noticing that I'm getting emotional as I'm saying that. Mm-hmm. So as you said, I'm a trauma repair coach. I use the word coach because there isn't really another good word for what I do, in the sense that I'm not a therapist, not trained as a therapist. The work that I do may end up looking or feeling, you know, a lot like, you know, therapy in terms of the scope of the topics that we talk about. Yeah. But I use coach because as you said earlier, I was trained as a yoga therapist. You know, I taught yoga for, I don't know how many years, since, you know, from 2007 to 2019, roughly. So yeah, a dozen years, and then, you know, trained and practiced as a yoga therapist. But what I noticed, and, you know, no, absolutely, I have so much love for yoga therapy. So when I say that it was not necessarily the right fit for me, it doesn't mean that yoga therapy isn't awesome. A lot of my dearest, closest friends are yoga therapists. Yeah. But what I noticed is that for the specific issues that I was working with in my body and in my life, and the issues that clients were coming to me with, yoga therapy was not it, right? Like it was helping. And what I noticed for me as somebody who's been sort of like in the yoga mindfulness, you know, meditation world, you know, for over a decade. I'm realizing like, oh, this is going to be controversial right off the bat, but I'm just going to go with it.
That's okay.
What it felt to me is it felt that we got really good at managing symptoms of trauma, but not mm-hmm. as good at going for the root causes. And of course, for a really long time, I didn't know that I was dealing with trauma, that my clients were coming to me with trauma, right? There was a reckoning moment, which happened last year in 2020, which we can talk more about, that I was like, oh, this is the thing, right? This yeah. is the thing that I've been looking for. This is the thing that I've been searching for, you know, sort of dancing around, you know, for a long time. But then there was like, oh, I really want to work with the root causes, right? And mm-hmm. I want to say too that this is true, you know, this I found to be true for my own personal process, and also for the folks that I work with. Usually the people that I work with they've been doing the personal development healing thing for a really long time, right? Mm-hmm. Like folks that I work with typically have been in therapy for years. They've been doing the yoga. They've been doing the witchy shit. They've been reading all the books. Usually a lot of them are really, really like well-versed in the world of, you know, like trauma and all of those things. And I think that all of the years that we've been doing this work, it's not like it's not doing anything, right? Like all yeah. the years that I was, you know, studying and practicing yoga as kind of like my primary healing method, really helped to condition and to build space in my nervous system, helped me build capacity so that when it was time to say, okay, now let's look at the trauma, let's look at the ways that needs have not been met, you know, for mm-hmm. for a lifetime, you know, since our infancy. Let's look at the grief that we've been carrying around since we were, you know, like tiny little children.
Yeah.
All of that work conditioned me and prepared me for that. And I think that it's that, and that's, I think it's the same for the folks that I work with. So it's not to say, oh, yoga, meditation, and all of those things don't do anything. That's not true. Mm-hmm. But for me, I was really interested in like, yeah, but what's underneath, right? Like, why are the, I don't want to just get good. I really, really good at managing the strong sensations when they're coming up. Yeah. I want to know why they're coming up. Why is this in my system? And is there a way that we can start to mitigate and reduce, right, the amount of the strong sensations coming up? And for me, trauma work has been the thing that's helped me do that.
Yeah, and let's define trauma as well for the folks who are hearing this word on my podcast maybe for the first time. I've talked about it a little bit, but based on the last year and the inner work that I've done with you and in Safe Haven, mm-hmm. your membership and all these things, there's so much to be unpacked around that. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word trauma, they don't really understand what we're talking about because they're thinking about shock trauma. They're thinking about like, oh, people who had absolutely terrible, like abusive childhoods or like a really terrible thing that gave them PTSD. And all of those things are real and valid. Mm-hmm. And there's other elements to trauma that I think we're just starting to understand. Right. Yeah.
And I think that that's a very important sort of frame to put around the definition and the conversation around trauma is two things. One is that, right, if you spend any time in sort of like the healing space, kind of like on Instagram or even on TikTok and so forth, you'll see the word trauma a lot. Like it's kind of it's become kind of like a trendy thing. It's become like, it's very much like a buzzword that people are using a lot. Whenever that's the case, there's always going to be some folks were right on the money. Some folks were a little bit beside the money. Some people who were actively weaponizing the terms and the terminology, you know, for yeah. their own ends. So there's a lot of that going on that kind of like, you know, makes the waters murky around trauma. And also that the kind of trauma that I work with and that we're mm-hmm. going to talk about, developmental trauma, sometimes called CPTSD or complex post-traumatic stress disorder, is actually, this field is relatively new, right? When yeah. we're talking about this level of trauma, this is a really new field. When we're talking about the nervous system, right? Big part of my work is working with polyvagal theory. Mm-hmm. And so working with the vagus nerve and how our system is wired for safety and connection, but because of the experiences that we have, sort of gets rewired for protection, and how that's a source of a lot of our pain and a lot of our discomfort. You know, polyvagal theory, I think, originated in, 1994, right? So we're talking mm-hmm. about relatively new concepts. Right. So all of this to say that I'm going to share sort of my definition of trauma, which is the one that I've developed sort of like for the way that I work with it. But that there are other ways to couch this. There's other kinds of language. Like, I'm not saying that my way is like the best, but I know that my way like sort of like really resonates with folks, which is that, you know, to me, trauma is a rupture in the relationship with the self, right? So it's the relationship that we have with ourselves gets ruptured as a result of our fundamental biological needs for safety and connection not being met in early childhood. And so that casts a much broader net, right, than what you said earlier of, it doesn't need to mean that like you need to have been, you know, like actively abused or neglected. There doesn't need to be those kind of gigantic big markers. Right. So something that gets talked about a lot in the developmental trauma field is the ACEs study, ACEs, adverse childhood experience. And so it's really easy to look that up. If you just type ACE study, you'll find it. And so it kind of tracks sort of like big milestones, right, that can happen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, neglect, parents divorce, you know, poverty, you know, having any number of marginalized identities will fall under that. And, you know, trauma will exist on a spectrum for sure, right? Like the more of these adverse experiences that you've had, the potentially deeper your experience of trauma, the potentially sort of like, you know, stickier the effects in your system might be over time. Yeah. But really what we're talking about is at the basis, like, were your parents' nervous systems regulated when you were little? You know, like, did they deal with stress? Was their marriage harmonious? You know, did your mom feel seen and heard and supported, right, in her role as a mom? Like, any and all of those things, if the answer is no, there's the potential there for that rupture to happen. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the work that I do is helping people repair that rupture, right? Because the idea is that trauma comes in and sort of ruptures the relationship that we have with ourselves, but it never severs it completely, right? Mm-hmm. It's never fully gone. There's always, to me, there's a part of us that remains untouched by trauma. Yeah. And there's a strong impulse to heal. There's a strong impulse to move towards vitality and joy and creativity and pleasure. That is innate. That doesn't go away, right? And so the work that I help people do is to help sort of integrate, right, what happened, and to start to make more and more space in their system for this vitality, for this healing, right? Mm-hmm. To reconnect to that part of themselves that trauma may have separated them from.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that definition. I feel like it's been wild to me to realize that definition of trauma being a rupture in the relationship to self, because mm-hmm. my work, you know, intersects with that in so many ways, in that, you know, like the relaunching of this podcast is all about, we're focusing on coming home to yourself and reclaiming your imagination. And all of those things are so interconnected to trauma and developmental trauma. And the work that I've done myself has been really interesting, realizing like, oh, I never thought that I had trauma. But then when we're talking about things and you're like, well, did you feel like you had a safe adult to go to when things happened, to really truly like talk about the things and feel totally seen? And what was wild for me is realizing like, no, not all the time. Like, I was a little too much for for my parents. Their nervous systems like weren't ready for such an extroverted like kid, you know? And so for me, that's been the developmental trauma piece. And it's been wild to dig into that and realize how connected it is to creativity, to our imaginations. Yeah. So my next question is about that. Like, how might developmental trauma affect one's creativity and imagination?
Oh, I mean, it's huge in a lot of ways. So when we're talking about developmental trauma, one of the things that we're talking about is how our nervous system gets conditioned to patterns of protection as opposed to patterns of connection, right? So so the reason why developmental trauma is so painful and has such deep repercussions is that feeling safe and seen in connection to another human and to ourselves, like, is our fundamental biological need. Like, we need it to survive. It's not just a nice thing that we get to have on top of the other stuff, right? Like, it's like if infants don't have it, they cannot survive. And so what happens is when there's a rupture in the relationship with the caregiver, then basically the child, the infant, is in a state of, you know, is in a state of survival, right? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, what we need to do is we need to find ways to work with our nervous system so that we can sort of survive the environment in which our fundamental need is not met. So what that means, and so when we're talking about creativity, when we're talking about, making new things in the world, really one of the key ingredients that we're talking about there is curiosity. Mm-hmm. Curiosity and play. And those are things that if your nervous system is in a constant state of fight or flight or freeze, if we're in, you know, sympathetic activation or dorsal vagal activation a lot of the time, we literally cannot be curious. Those are actually nervous system states that cannot coexist, right? And so it's huge, right? It's huge, the impact, just from, because it really minimizes our ability to get into the nervous system states that are necessary, right, to sustain creativity. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that, you know, there is no state of the nervous system that is necessarily like all the time. Even for folks who are sort of chronically stuck in one nervous system state or another, we'll still navigate all of the different states, you know, in the course of a day, in the course of our lifetime. So it doesn't mean that we never have access to that, right? Like, so you might have access to curiosity, you know, some of the time, but the rupture in the relationship with the self might mean that there might be a lot of judgment. There might be a lot of shame, right? Like all of those voices, right, that we kind of integrate, and we do it for a good reason. We do it for survival, right? But when we integrate the voices of our caregivers, of our environment that says we're too much, we take up too much space, we're weird, you know, we don't make sense, like all of the wonderful attributes that, you know, make artists, you know, like so fantastic and that enables artists to do their work, all of a sudden, these are things that we might judge and shame ourselves for, right? And therefore, we're kind of like minimize that expression. So yeah, it's huge. And I'm sure that there's a lot more that I'm not thinking about, but I wanted to bring that curiosity piece, like specifically, it's very important.
That's so huge. Curiosity and play. And I think it really helped me with my work understand why so many adults are so hesitant when it comes to play and just don't know how to do it, because we're so used to those self-protecting strategies. And I'd love it if you say more about how those strategies are actually helpful, like until they're not, because that's been so huge for me too, is realizing, I think like when I first started talking about my inner critic on this podcast, like my relationship with Harold, so lovingly named, was really, really aggressive. Like it was very much like, fuck off, Harold. I'm like, fuck you. And it was kind of like go to war with your inner critic. And the more that I've learned about developmental trauma and where that voice comes from, the more I've been like, oh, this is my protector voice. He's trying to protect me. He's doing this because of XYZ. And let's like have a nice conversation give him a cup of milk or juice or whatever, and like let him take a nap, you know, like all of these
Yes.
things. So would you talk more about that, like how we kind of misrepresent, I think, our inner critic voice and don't
Yeah.
realize?
I can talk about this for hours. Actually, it
Yeah.
was very interesting because recently, I think I talked to you about this, but like I picked up the book The Artist's Way recently for the first time in like probably nearly 20 years. Like it's been a really, really long time since my last
Yeah.
go around with it. And I was really kind of enthusiastic about going through, you know, doing through the program. But what I found is that this is kind of like generally the case for me right now is that like I can't read books anymore if they don't talk about developmental trauma because I'm like, you're not talking about the real thing. You're not,
Right.
this is just my kind of like very obnoxious, you know, sort of like, you know, professional lens on things, but I'm like, which is like always my cue to myself, like it's time for you to write your own book because
Right. It's like
I'm
if you're triggered, being curious and not judgmental, let's get curious about why you're triggered. Maybe you need to write a book or three.
I do. I do. But yeah, but that was the kind of the first one of the things. It was that very thing, right? The way that the relationship with the inner critic is, and I mean, like I'm not hating on Julia Cameron. Like I think her book is fantastic. I've been doing Morning
Totally.
Pages for probably about 20 years, right? Like it's just to say that, like, oh, we don't know what we don't know until we know it. And I think that
Right.
for a really long time, you know, specifically in the field of self-help and sort of personal development in general, which I'm going to sort of wrap, you know, a book like The Artist's Way inside of, it's been very much it's been all about the mind, right? And changing our thoughts and changing the mindset has been sort of like the gold standard, right? And so it makes sense if you're like, well, I'm basically just a brain and I have this voice in my brain that's Harold's voice, right? That is my inner critic that is talking shit to me all the time when I'm trying to make a painting. Then it makes sense. Okay, well, let's just replace that with another voice. And on the face of it, that makes some sense. And it's not like it. And it may have worked to some degree for some people. Obviously, you know, like The Artist's Way is a hugely successful book.
Right.
And, you know, and I'm not saying that if it worked for you, that that's wrong for some reason, but it hasn't worked for everybody. And I think that, yeah, one of the things is that if we're not taking into consideration how the nervous system is actually driving all of our actions, it's really all about the nervous system and the neuroception of safety or danger that the nervous system sort of like perceives. It's really not like our conscious thoughts are not guiding our reality the way that we the way that, you know, our sort of like, you know, capitalist sort of like patriarchal sort of, you know, society really wants us. That's just really not true, right? It's just really not true. It's not about our conscious thoughts. It's
Yeah.
about our unconscious, you know, need for safety. So to answer your question, so in this case in particular, right, like you're talking about Harold, right, your inner voice, right, and how if we're looking at it from the perspective of, well, I just want to make some art because that's who I am and it's what I do and it's what I love, and then this voice is coming in and whatever it is that they're saying, right, is going to fall somewhere in the judgment, shame, blame sort of soup, right, is preventing me from doing that work, then that must be bad, right? There must be something wrong with it. But if we understand it from the perspective of the nervous system and of developmental trauma, which is that we are wired for connection, then we remain wired for connection to our attachment figures all the time, right? Like if it's unexamined, right? So in childhood, if you got the message that I'm too much, I'm too extroverted, there's, you know, like I take up too much space, you know, making art is being too much and taking too much space. And your art in particular is very, you know, riotous with color and imagery and all of that, right? It's a lot. And so what happens to the nervous system is like, oh, if I make this art that is a lot because that is who I am and that is what is beautiful to me, then there is a risk that I might lose connection with my caregivers. right? And so that's when we talk about neuroception of danger. So neuroception is perception without awareness. So that's the ways that your nervous system is scanning your environment for cues of safety or cues of danger all the time. And it happens below your conscious thought, right? So even before, you know how you get a feeling about somebody walk in a room and you're like, things are not cool here. That's your neuroception, right? But yeah, if you've been conditioned in childhood to say, well, I need to be a certain way in order to secure the love and the care and the attention of my caregivers, and that way is neat and small and quiet, right? Then anything that's going to try to take you out of that is going to be perceived as a risk for your nervous system. So that inner voice, right? That herald voice. We could look at it from the perspective of, oh, it's trying to hinder me from doing my art. But really what it's trying to do is it's trying to keep you safe because it's trying to keep you in connection with your caregivers. And the thing about it is that was a necessary, life-saving, and extremely effective strategy when you were little and you were completely dependent on your caregivers for everything, right? For your survival. You did not have any agency. You can get a job. You can say, well, fuck these people. Can we swear on this podcast?
Yeah,
It's your
absolutely.
podcast, so I'm assuming,
All the
all the time. So you can't just say like, fuck these people, my needs are not being met here, I'm going to get a job and I'm going to get an, you can't do that, right? As a child, like you're dependent. And so that strategy was really life-saving at that moment because, I mean, first of all, you're still here, right? So it worked. But what happens, the way that I describe that is kind of like hermit crabs in their shells, right? So that strategy was really protective and really life-giving at that time when you were smaller, right? And so like, oh, it was like that strategy was your little shell and you're safe and warm inside of it. And it's like, cool, okay, I got the shell, I'm good to go. But what happens to the hermit crab and what happens to you is you keep growing inside of that shell. And so we get to a moment where like actually what was once life-saving and protective is now starting to be restrictive and is now actually starting to threaten our life. Because it's threatening our vitality, it's threatening our expression, right? And so that's kind of like that really kind of illustrates, right, the change that you've had in your relationship with Harold from being like, like just being all mad and like talking shit to Harold to like, oh, do you need some nap? Do you need a nap and do you need some juice? Right. Because you're kind of like, oh, right. So you, I see why you're here. You're here to keep me safe and you're here to keep me alive. Got it. Actually, so thank you so much, right, Harold? Thank you so much for what the hard work that you've been doing for me my whole life. Actually, don't need you anymore. Right? You're like, I need a different shell now. Like, I need a different kind of embodied safety that is based on agency and consent and my values and beliefs as a grown up, right? And as a person who no longer depends on my caregivers for my survival.
Yeah, fuck. Absolutely. We've talked about this before, but every time we talk about it again, I'm like, oh, everyone needs to know about this because
They do.
it helps make everything make so much more sense. Like the reactions you have, like why a blank canvas scares the shit out of you. Like, of course, because I think you've said before, your nervous system is always just trying to keep you safe, which equals small and not change, right?
So the nervous system, safe is small and the same, right? So feelings that are small, not too big, and the same, sort of predictable, right? And I mean, we don't make art to stay small and safe and the same. Like, we don't. That's not the
Kind
point.
of the opposite.
Yes.
Yeah, and I love you've also said before about how when especially when you're younger and a child, like the nervous system developmentally is always going to choose like that attachment to your caregivers over authenticity, which is really interesting to me because authenticity, right, is something that I talk about all the time. And how does one kind of move from that place where they're in this smaller shell of attachment, right? And they want to get to a place where they're more in the shell of authenticity. Like, what is that transition and transformation like for people that you're working with?
It's gnarly. It's not great. So first of all, I want to credit, so that attachment and authenticity, that's a Gabor Mate quote. He's one of my absolute favorite sort of like trauma scholars. And so he says that, you know, human beings have two basic needs, attachment and authenticity. And when authenticity threatens attachment, attachment will win every single time. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that that's more, that's when we're kind of unaware of these patterns, right? Like if that's kind of like that, that's when everything is, that's when the process is kind of like, you know, automatic, when we're working solely off of autonomic nervous system processes, and when we're not necessarily like coming in with the ability to make choices, which we have and which we cultivate. Right. So yeah, so that process of transformation is, like I said, like it's gnarly. So if we want to think about, and my metaphor breaks down a little bit here because I haven't actually researched that much into hermit crabs. But if we imagine, right, like our little hermit crab buddy, you know, once they leave, there's this inherent moment of vulnerability and risk, right? When we're going to move from one shell to the other shell, like when we're like, okay, even though this shell is too small and it is actually threatening, like it once saved me, but it's actually now threatening my life and I need to move. There still has this moment where I'm going to have to be without a shell for an amount of time. And I feel, and that is very vulnerable. It's very risky. It's very difficult. It's very difficult work to do. And what I want to say is that it's perceived as difficult, right? Like the nervous system perceives it as really risky and therefore sort of kicks us into these, you know, in these, you know, survival states, either fight or flight or freeze or fawn. Most of the time though, like the stakes are not that high. They're just kind of perceived as being that high.
Right.
So one key piece, and so most of my training in trauma comes from an institute called NARM. It's the Neuroaffective Relational Model. I took their online basics training last summer, the first time that it was offered. It's a training for therapists usually, but they've made it accessible to all kinds of practitioners. So lots of, you know, coaches, clergy, you know, social workers, people who work in, you know, residential rehab programs, et cetera. So that's where I took sort of like, so that's where I got like all of this juicy stuff from. Mostly all from NARM. So shout out. But one of the key pieces in NARM, the model, and really kind of the answer to your question, how do we move from the small shell? How do we go through the scary process of moving from the small shell to the bigger shell that will now accommodate how big and loud and fantastic and joyous we want to be? And the question to that, and the answer to that, is agency, right? So in the language in NARM, they actually talk about agency as being the bridge from child consciousness, which is really where we are and where we live when we're kind of led by these patterns of protection, right? Like, I need to stay small. I need to stay the same. I need to stay predictable. I need to stay whatever my caregivers need me to be, right? That's child consciousness too. I want to make this big, bold, audacious, like, you know, like daring art. That's adult consciousness, and agency is the bridge. And what we're talking about agency, remember earlier we were talking about like when you're a kid, one of the reasons that developmental trauma happens is that we don't have agency, right? We cannot give or revoke consent to what happens to us. And we don't have the means to up and leave our environment. And we don't have the means to change our environment, right? We can't change our caregivers. We can't change anything about the world around us, really. The only thing that we have a hope of changing is ourselves. And so that's what we do. We act in, and that's where shame comes in. Like, oh, I need to be small. I need to stay. I need to stay in these predictable confines. But what happens is that like the strategies keep going because your nervous system doesn't get the memo that you're now a grown-ass human who pays their own bills, right? And who literally, no, but it's true, your nervous system never got the memo that you do not need the relationship with your caregivers in order to survive anymore. Like that needs to be a conscious process. And so the conscious process is kind of is tapping into agency, right? Like, how do I have the ability to effect change in myself and in my environment, right? And so it's really starting to, and that's it for me. Like when I talk about doing the trauma repair work, a lot of times you'll hear me talk about becoming a safe caregiver to yourself, right? And that's really what it is kind of going like, oh, say, I know that the grown-ups around you were not safe for most of your childhood. And or weren't safe, you know, doesn't have to be were never safe, but weren't safe enough of the time, weren't safe all the time, right? And so you had to develop these protective patterns, right? This shell. But like actually now there is a safe grown up. And the safe grown up is you, right? The safe grown up is me. And so by tapping into agency, the fact of like, oh, I actually don't need these people to survive anymore. And oh, I'm actually in charge of a lot of this stuff. And oh, I can make choices. I can say no. I can set boundaries, right? Like I can move, I can create change in the world, right? That is what helps us sort of like make the shift.
And that's really, there's so much hope in that, right? The fact that our nervous systems and our brains can be rewired, and that there's like neuroplasticity, and that we can learn. Because a lot of times I feel like when folks learn about this developmental trauma, like maybe the first reaction is like, oh shit, like
Oh,
this
shit.
happened to me, and like, am I stuck this way? And the answer is no, you're not stuck.
You're really
And
not.
yeah, and like there are people to help you, including you, Fanny, and like the work that you do. And I love that I've talked about reparenting on the podcast before, and now we have like this deeper way of understanding, like you're the grown-up. You get to like reparent yourself and let them know, hey, you're safe now. Like let's, you know, you're safe. I get the picture of like almost a dog, you know, who's been abused, who like is just kind of cowering and is not used to love and nurturing. And it's kind of like you're just letting them know, like, hey, okay, there's food and water out here. There's no pressure. You know, whenever you're ready, I'm here to love on you. And that's going to be a whole ass process,
It's going to
right?
be a whole ass process. And I love that you use, I actually use that. I actually use that analogy in teaching sometimes of the like, okay, so there's a scared little kitten under your porch, you know, and how you're going to demonstrate right to that scared animal that you're safe is you're just kind of going to sit nearby and just kind of ground your nervous system and just kind of, and you're going to wait for them to come out. And that's the biggest piece, right? That work has to be done at the pace of right the being that was hurt, you know, that was harmed. You said something earlier about like the hopefulness of this the potentially the possibility of rewiring the nervous system, which I'm so glad that you touched on that. And I totally hear that, and you know, it might feel like we're stuck, right? Like when we come into this awareness. And the other piece, so you know, would say like, you know, if we're making the transition, agency is a really big piece. And then the other big piece is tempering and creating room in the nervous system to be with a lot of discomfort, because what we're going to have to do in order to really make this transition, to really leave child consciousness behind and to fully step into the agency and possibility of our adult consciousness, is we're going to have to reckon with the grief of not having had those needs met when we were little. And I think that that's where, you know, I was actually like having that conversation with my own therapist, you know, yesterday. And she was like, yeah, that's why people don't do therapy. Because like ultimately at some point, right, if you're doing the work, you're gonna find this box of grief and sadness and hurt that has been waiting kind of your whole life, right? It was always like it wasn't safe. It wasn't safe to feel. You know, if you're tiny, if you're small, and the grown-ups around you are not safe, you know, for you to have these big feelings, you know, you're going to have to put the feelings somewhere, but you can't fully get rid of them, right? So a lot of times they just kind of, they get piled, you know. So for me, the image that I have is like, they get put in a box, you know, and the box is in the basement, in the far dusty cobwebby corner of the basement, and it's kind of not looked at, you know, for most of our life. And then what happens, you know, earlier I was talking about, you know, we do yoga, we go to therapy for years, we practice meditation, we do the witchcraft stuff, you know, like we have these different practices. All of that builds the capacity of our nervous system to where usually people, when they kind of show up kind of in my realm, you know, like I needed to work with me in some ways, usually they're at a point where the nervous system is like, okay, it's time. Okay, we're ready. And then what that means is, okay, then we get to drag that box up from the basement and open it up. And so there's a definite sense of, it feels like shit gets so much worse before it gets better, because in a lot of ways we haven't looked, we haven't been the safe grown up, you know, to be able to create a container for that grief, you know, for most of our life. And now we are, you know, but really that, to me, that grief is the thing that keeps us stuck, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like we could have, we probably will have a whole other episode about grief and about embodiment, because we could really get into that even more too. And I'm sure we will, because I think like you're so right on, and I've experienced this in like working with you and with my therapist and all of this in the process of being like, okay, I'm doing better as a caregiver for myself. And then my inner child is like, okay, so now that it's safe, like here's all this stuff. And to me, it feels like a whole ass cavern in there of just like, whoa, there's a lot to deal with. And like, this sucks. And you've reminded me so many times of like, yeah, that's because you're safe now. So your inner child is like, oh, well, you're safe. Like, here's all the secrets that I've been keeping from you because you haven't been safe. But like, here they are, right?
Yeah. It's a lot. I'm, you know, I'm pretty deep in one of those layers, you know, right now. And it's a lot. And I don't know if you can hear, I can sense it in my voice. Like I can, I can feel that the emotion is coming in because, you know, because for me, like, you know, I've had occasion to reflect on this a lot. It's like, I'm literally like a trauma professional. Like I have structured my whole life around being able to do this work with and for myself and with the people that I work with. And so I am really resourced, really skilled. Right. Like I like, and I hold a lot of privilege to where like I have a lot of space in my life to be able to feel this stuff. And it it brings me to my knees. Like it wrecks me. It's so hard to feel. It's so hard to feel as an adult, to feel the force. Like for me as an adult, to feel the force now in my nervous system of that grief. And I'm 42 years old. Like this shit's been around for a while and it's overwhelming to my system now. And so for me to think about what that must have felt like for me as an infant, you know, it's just like, it's, and, you know, you and I both have kiddos, right? So to think about like, oh, well, what would this be like, you know, in the nervous system for my kiddo? It's like, oh man, it's brutal. It's really hard. And so, and so there's, I'm really kind of holding space for both of those things. Like you mentioned, like the hopefulness, right? We are not stuck. The nervous system, your brain, all of that is completely plastic. It can be rewired. I've seen just astounding transformations, right? Like in myself and folks that I've worked with, it's absolutely possible. And there's so much joy in that possibility. And we're gonna have to go through the ringer to get there, because there's no way to get to the new shell, right? Like without really dealing and reckoning with why we needed the first shell in the first place, you know? Cause like in a, you know, in a perfect world, there would not be a shell. You wouldn't need the shell, right? Like you would be met by your caregivers who are safe and regulated, which means they have a village, right, around them to help support them. And we would be, you know, in we would be in connection, we would be in safety. And it doesn't need to be all the time. There's always going to be rupture. But if there's a rupture and then there's a repair, then the nervous system can kind of go on its merry way, right? And that should be our reality, you know, and it's not. And we're not going to be able to reclaim that, right? To reclaim that agency, that reclaiming, you know, our vitality, our joy, our creativity, our curiosity, being the safe caregivers who are able to make the decisions, the choices in our lives, you know, that we're not going to be able to do any of that without reckoning with the grief.
Yeah. And you like so beautifully brought it right back to like why it's so important to do this inner work and like, and come back home to our imaginations and all of those things, because like doing that work, getting the resources, like gathering that village around you, that community, is the work to be able to build a better future and to be able to build these spaces either digitally or like in person. And it's really beautiful seeing that work happening and being a part of it. And so as we're wrapping up here, I'd love if you would talk about the Safe Haven community and what that is and the things that are coming up that you're excited about within that.
Yeah. Okay. So great question. So what I didn't say earlier when we, you know, talking about the definition of trauma, because that also could be an entire podcast, but that like trauma is relational, right? Like it doesn't happen to a person in a vacuum. It always happens inside of relationships. And because of that, because that the rupture happens in relationship always, then it makes sense that the healing would have to happen in relationships as well. And I think that one of the legacies of our cis hetero patriarchal capitalist white supremacist society, right? Like here in the West, you know, in the US in particular, there's this really strong focus on the individual, right? The individual's capacity to heal and change. We take on so much responsibility, right? For fixing ourselves and doing that work on our own. And, you know, quite honestly, it can't be done, right? Like the healing needs to happen in relationships and ideally in community. And so that's one of the reasons why I created Safe Haven, which is a monthly membership group. You've been a member since the beginning. We've been running it for a year now. It was our 1 year anniversary in early this month. And it's a monthly membership where it's called Safe Haven because the idea is that the group itself is a safe haven so that we can become a safe haven for ourselves so that we can then be a safe haven for each other, right? So the idea is that the work that we do in the membership together, right, is become a safe haven, a safe caregiver for ourselves so that we can then go out in our relationships in the world and being a safe haven to people outside, you know? So the idea is that, you know, the community healing sort of like ripples out. From there. And what was amazing is that like I started the group with a lot of faith and a lot of hope and kind of a fingers crossed kind of feeling that's like, I think this is gonna work, but you just don't know, right? Like you just don't know. And then actually getting into the space has made me even like an even stronger, firmer believer in the power of community to heal. What we've seen happen is just the kind of connection, the kind of vulnerability that we've seen happen has been so, so incredible, so inspiring and so humbling, you know, for me as the leader. I kind of lost my train of thought there.
That's okay. I would love to jump in and like also.
Yes, just please. Say, go ahead.
Like I've started describing all of my favorite spaces, digital and in person, as like blanket forts, basically. Yes. And Safe Haven does feel like a blanket fort with like the twinkle lights, and we've got, you know, the coffee,
the stuffed animals,
the stuffed animals, and all the warm fuzzies, but also like it's a safe space to be witnessed. Like there's so much that we're all processing, like individually and collectively, and there's such a need for community care because, like you said, like we're so individualistic and there's toxic individualism that we have going on right now in our society to where we feel like we should do it all alone and that we should be able to do it all alone, which we are absolutely not wired for. So we need community care. Like it's not a maybe, it's not just like a nice thing, it's an absolute like ground level
It's
need
a
that
must,
we
yeah.
have.
And I thank you for that, and that picked me up again, because like we started this interview talking about witnessing, right? And that remains to me the most sort of like powerful aspect of Safe Haven and of these kind of group spaces, you know, membership spaces or group programs or otherwise. Because at the root of our developmental trauma is the fact that we were hurt and there was nobody there to hold witness for us, right? One of my, I think this definition of trauma is from Peter Levine. I'm not sure, but it's something along the lines of trauma isn't what happens to us, it's what happens to inside of us in the absence of an empathetic witness, right? And so at the core of trauma is the fact of like, it's not just I'm hurting, but it's I'm hurting and nobody is seeing me. I'm not witnessed. And so what group, what Safe Haven, you know, and other groups like it offer is this fundamental witness, this like, I see you. And it's such a powerful healing modality. You know, as you know, a lot of times what we do in this space, I mean, I'm in there and I offer some education, I offer some, you know, I offer some framing, right? A lot of times for stuff people are going is like, my nervous system, like this is going on and I don't understand. I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense from a nervous system perspective. Here's what's going on. And that's really helpful. But what is the most powerful is being able to be really vulnerable, right? That little hermit, like that little hermit crab coming out of the shell, being able to be really vulnerable in a group of people and having people just go, I see you. I see you. And it's like, I think it's the most profound, potent medicine that we have to offer each other, which is I see you. And, you know, I offer both, you know, one-on-one coaching and Safe Haven, which is a group program. And there's absolutely room for both. And there's utility in both, but there's something in Safe Haven that I cannot offer in a one-on-one session. There's only so much the me telling you, the other person, you make total sense. This makes total sense. And you are not alone. But there's something about having a room full of people, right? Like whether it's in an online meeting or, you know, in a Slack channel, having the multiple people and going like, oh, not only do I see you, but I feel you. Me too, right? Me too. There's a level of that that I can't provide in a one-on-one session that Safe Haven can provide. And it's just magic. Like I just don't, there's no other real way to kind of describe it. Like it's absolute magic. And for me, like as the space holder and the creator of the group, I still remain, right, like a witness and in awe of that magic, right? Like every month when we have two different live calls a month, and it blows me away every single time.
Yeah, it makes me think of one of my other mentors, El Luna. I think she described it as like having a circle of compassionate mirrors. Like just, you know, like it's not just 'cause there's something powerful with one-to-one like mirroring and really reflecting and not trying to offer advice. 'Cause I think that's another huge thing is just holding the space and reflecting back as opposed to being like, ooh, instead of sitting with that, let me like try to fix you because I don't have the resources. So like, you know, we could have a whole
A
conversation
whole,
about that.
yes.
But like
Let's please.
we will. What's so great about Safe Haven and some of these other spaces that I have found and now I'm trying to cultivate here with Darling Revolution as well, is that it's a space where you have compassionate mirrors all around you and no one's trying to rush your process. No one's trying to diagnose you. No one's trying to fix you. Everyone is just there like, yeah, man, that's hard. I see you. And there's something that like cracks open when someone just simply says like, I see you.
Well, it because it to me when, you know, I'm always like I'm like a heat seeking missile for root causes. Like I just, and to me that's the fundamental root of our trauma is our pain was not seen. It wasn't witnessed. And because it wasn't witnessed, it wasn't seen, it wasn't held. It had to go underground. So when somebody else just says, "Hey, I see that you're hurting, and it's okay, and I'm not going to leave, right? I'm going to stay right here with you." That goes right to the root. Right to the root. And then that enables us to, like having that witness is one of the things that enables us to step away from child consciousness, because you're like, oh, that closes that loop, right? That pain needed to be seen, and it's seen and it's held now. That closes that loop. That enables us to move on.
Yeah, and it really gets us into the cycle of movement that is like healing, right? Because as we're like wrapping this up for this session anyway, we'll definitely have more conversations, because I'm like, you and I could just talk for like 6 hours basically. Is that I'm reminded of the fact that when we're doing this work, not just self-care and community care and trauma work and all these things, it's not like you're trying to get to a place of achieving like adult consciousness or like achieving like healing. It's more, it makes me think of the tarot card, like the Wheel of Fortune, like that healing is movement. It's not a location. It's healing is being able to move through discomfort into comfort and back again, and being able to hold space for the stuff that comes up. 'Cause like to be a human is to be messy, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is a super good note to end on too, because I think that a lot of the what we tend to do, because we have a built-in negativity bias, in the brain and nervous system that helps us survive, but we have a tendency to identify with the parts of us that are hurt, that are traumatized. That tends to take up a lot more space in our consciousness. And folks don't have a tendency to see or to value the ways in which adult consciousness is here. We don't have to make it up, right? Like, we don't have, like, you have access to it. You, in fact, connect with it every day. You might not see it that way. You might not value it that way. You might not give it that much weight, but it's there. And so that's a big part of like my work when I work with folks one-on-one, is sort of like, yeah, but do you see how your system is organizing here? Like, oh, do you see that? Oh, I see, like, because I can see it, right? Like, and see how people are connecting to it. And yeah, the idea is that this is a really good point. Like, it's not outside of yourself, and that you need to like slog through the desert, to go and find it. No, it was always inside. It was always your birthright, right? And it's a matter of reconnecting and reclaiming. To me, that movement feels really different.
Oh, so good. Thank you so much, Fanny. I love this conversation. And I really like ending just on a fun note with some rapid fire questions.
Oh, yay. Okay.
Let's do that and then we'll wrap up. So rapid fire, whatever comes to mind first, it's totally fine. So what is your favorite way to recharge?
Oh, I think you know the answer to this one, but it's taking baths. Definitely. Like, I have an elaborate setup for taking baths. And I'm recovering from surgery right now, and I can't take baths because I can't immerse my ankle. And I'm actually not okay. I'm not okay without it. So I have like an elaborate setup of like taking salt baths at night, like listening to very specific playlists. Like, that is my everything. Yeah, a
So
bathtub.
clearly, the second that you're able to take baths again, it will have to be just like an even more elaborate, like
I
maybe
think
a
so.
half a day, like.
It will be a long. Oh my gosh! So I have. So sorry. Last night. So I have a window in my bathroom, and last night for the first time, I've been in the suite in here for like since September. The moon was shining directly into my bathtub last night, and I couldn't take a
Whoa.
bath. Yeah, I
Oh.
know. It was
Wow.
heartbreaking. I was like, oh no.
So
Anyways, but the
painful.
time will come. Yes.
I see you in your pain about not being able
I
to
feel
take advantage
seen.
of the full moon. Oh my gosh. Oh, well, what are you obsessed with right now besides baths?
Am I obsessed with right now? I'm gonna say rainbows. Excuse me, burp. I'm gonna say rainbows. Rainbows have like emerged as like just an obsession, like over the last year. It started with you actually, and doodle jam processes. And then like, what I noticed is that like, one of my favorite things to do is just getting out my colored pencils and just like putting them in rainbow order. Mm-hmm. Like that just pleases my brain endlessly. And then it's just kind of blossomed into this kind of like full blown expression where now like I have like rainbow bangs and yeah,
you
like
are the rainbow.
I am the rainbow. I am the rainbow. I'm pretty obsessed. I'm pretty gay. Rainbows. I'm going to say rainbows.
I love that so much. Any last recent good TV show binges that you've been in?
I am super obsessed with Mayor of Easttown, which is an HBO show that is running right now. They're doing the thing where they run it once a week, which is like really a drag.
We can't wait for things now.
We just like, really can't. But so they just aired the penultimate episode last night. So there's one more episode. It's Kate Winslet, who is it's like this like gritty family detective murder solving thing. And it's like set in a very particular area of Pennsylvania where they have like a very particular accent. And anyways, the whole, it's beautiful. It's brilliant. It's so well done. I am just transfixed by Kate Winslet in this role. And I'm super into it. So yeah. And so we just watched like the second to last episode last night and I'm obsessed.
Amazing. Putting it on my list.
And then Parks and Rec forever and ever and ever, obviously.
Forever. Parks and Rec and The Office are like my comfort foods when it comes to TV. I'm just like, I need comfort. I will watch those shows. Mm-hmm. What is something that is in your everyday life that makes you smile?
There are a lot of things. I'm going to say my coffee mugs. So I love coffee. I drink decaf coffee because I can't do caffeinated coffee because I will climb the walls. But another, one of the things that I got obsessed with over in 2020 is these East Fork pottery mugs. So I just kind of got obsessed with their stuff and started like my little collection. And I just like, that's my favorite thing. I start the day, I set my coffee pot the night before. And then like in the morning I have my coffee and I choose my mug. And that's one of the happiest things in my day.
I love it. I too have my morning coffee ritual and it's like the best thing. What is on your playlist right now?
Kind of the same thing all the time, which is mostly like 70s, 80s, and 90s jams. That's a whole other, we could also have a podcast about this, about like the nervous system regulating possibilities with playlists. But what I've noticed that is in my sort of like reparenting work and my safe caregiver work with myself, like connecting to music that was like important to me and made sense to me, like as a kid, has been a really real, so that like, that was been a huge regulating force for me over like the last year. And so, and right now, you know, I was born in 78 and I'm noticing right now that like music from the sort of mid to late 70s too is like really like just does something to my nervous system. Like it's a glimmer, right? Like it gets me into my ventral vagal. So I rock out to a lot of like Elton John and Bowie and Fleetwood Mac, obviously. and obviously like I'm, you know, missing some right now, but like just kind of like that general vibe a lot. That's
such good stuff. And you know, I love a good playlist. I am all about it. So where can folks find you if they want to connect and more deeply with your work?
Yeah. So I'm the traumawitch.com and at trauma period witch on Instagram. And those are kind of the places that I hang out. I don't do a ton of social media, but like Instagram is the one that makes the most sense to me. So they can go there to connect with me. I'm usually pretty chatty in DMs. So when folks have questions, they can always feel free to reach out. And I'm sure that you're going to do show notes and so forth, but I have a free masterclass called How to Repair Trauma and Cultivate Self-Trust that is really robust, like really kind of goes into sort of like the science of everything we've been talking about. So I bring in the, nervous system piece. So we go over polyvagal theory, we go over like, developmental trauma, and then how to begin to repair. So if, listening to this today and you're like, oh, I need to know more, then yeah, you can go and watch that training. And then the doors to Safe Haven are open as well, if you'd like to join the community.
Fabulous. And yes, I highly recommend that training because it is very robust. And
it's really robust.
A lot of amazing information. So yeah, thank you so much, Fanny, for being on the show. I love you a lot.
This is so good. I love you so much. Looking forward to the next time.
Same. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we will catch you next time. Bye.
Thank you so much for being here with me. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Thank you for coming back on this journey with me as we navigate what the Darling Revolution looks like moving forward. If you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast. Leave a review on iTunes. That really, really helps us to get some visibility. And if you really loved it, send it to a friend who you think would appreciate it as well. I'll see you next time. Bye for now, friend.